From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest on this edition of the program, Parag Khanna, founder and managing partner of the management consulting firm FutureMap, which is a data-driven and scenario-based strategic advisory firm. Khanna is also author of the recently released book, Move, The Forces Uprooting Us. Parag Khanna has advised many governments and corporations around the world and serves on the boards of numerous financial institutions and technology companies. He previously advised the U.S. National Intelligence Council's Global Trends 2030 program and has published essays in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and the Financial Times. His popular TED Talks have garnered more than 3 million viewers. Khanna is also the author of more than 7 books, among which are The Future is Asian, Commerce, Conflict, and Culture in the 21st Century, and a trilogy of books on the future of the world order. Khanna holds a PhD from the London School of Economics and was recognized as a young global leader by the World Economic Forum. Parag Khanna's new book, Move, The Forces Uprooting Us, was released in early October. Its premise is that for 60,000 years, humanity has traveled across the world, and this movement has been influenced by conflict, disease, and lack of resources. Now we are on the verge of a new age of movement as climate change worsens and technology reaches new heights amid governmental and economic chaos. And Parag Khanna joins us via Microsoft Teams to discuss his new book, Move, The Forces Uprooting Us, and of course to talk about the work and impact of his innovative company, FutureMap. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. So great to be with you.
Yes, I'd like to mention that you are on a different part of the world than here in Washington, Singapore. Is that right?
I am for now.
Okay. Well, we'll hear more about that. But first, congratulations on your book.
Thank you.
And the theme, as evinced by the title, I guess, couldn't even be more relevant, the forces upending us in relation to migration. And you seem to posit it as a positive trend. What makes you say that when we are seeing harmful results, you know, politically, we're seeing refugees fleeing Syria. This was several years ago, and how that had an adverse impact on the trend of xenophobia in Europe. And now we're seeing the Taliban return to Afghanistan, also fueling a certain amount of xenophobia here in the United States and even in Europe.
Well, first and foremost, mobility is intrinsic to who we are as human beings. It's literally part of human nature. We have been nomadic for hundreds of thousands of years. A good percentage of the world population became more sedentary in the last couple of thousand years, or particularly the last couple of hundred years. But that doesn't mean that to move is not human. It is very human. And in some societies, we've lost touch with that capacity for mobility, whereas mobility is, in fact, how we embrace opportunity. And the fact that you have more migrants, more expatriates in the world today than ever in history is a testament to the fact that people voluntarily seek to move and relocate in search of that opportunity, or to escape harm, or to flee climate change. You could have political migrants, economic migrants, climate migrants. We have all three today. And of course, we'll talk about climate migrants, which is now the largest category of migrants in the world. But these things actually, in reality, blend together quite a bit. So, of course, there are situations where having a large-scale sudden influx of political refugees, asylum seekers, and so forth can be destabilizing in the politics. But, you know, we should first and foremost look at it from the standpoint of what improves a person's life. How do we save a life? How do we improve a life? And the fact is that if you are fleeing a radical government, civil war, or a natural disaster, or, you know, a calamitous economic situation, movement is good. Movement is positive. Movement is a relative improvement on the situation you were in before. Would most Afghans prefer to not be living under the Taliban right now? Probably. But since it has taken over, those people who would otherwise be persecuted, they have fled, they have moved, they have migrated. And it's our responsibility, our duty, if we can't change the government, to welcome them. At least I'd like to conceive of it as our duty, as our obligation. And that's the way it works with climate migration as well. It's all of our fault in some ways, particularly the countries that over centuries have emitted the most greenhouse gases and so forth. But whatever it is, it's a collective action problem, and we need to focus on adaptation. And by and large, whether the stimulus is a political one, economic one, or environmental one, the most tried and true form of adaptation in human history is to move.
Well, I definitely take your point. And of course, it made me realize listening to you that immigration, for example, is the very cornerstone of the United States. It's what enriched and it continues to enrich our own country. People from all over the world, we are considered, you know, this so-called proverbial melting pot. But I did want to bring up what many see, particularly those on the right and those who do not like the idea of immigration. And this does put us in a bind when we are, as you said, in a situation where whether it's climate change, political upheaval, you know, economic instability and lack of opportunities, we're seeing many more people on the move, and it is having somewhat of a negative impact. How does a country, let's say even the United States, deal with factions who do not see migration as positive? Or even in Europe, we're seeing the rise of a number of right-wing or neo-fascist type movements who are trying to fight this natural movement of people.
Well, it's important not to generalize about, let's say, you know, and you didn't say this, but, you know, if people say the West has become populist and xenophobic and anti-immigrant, that's just not true. Right? Because last time I checked, countries like Germany, countries like Canada are very much part of the West. And in Canada, you just had an election. And yet again, you have a very strong consensus in favor of massive increases in immigration, right? The Canadian population is increasing by 400,000 people per year. That's 1%, more than 1% of the country's population. So that's really, really remarkable. And Germany, despite the fact that more than 1 million Syrian, Iraqi, and other refugees and asylum seekers were let into the country in 2015 and 2016, and they slowed that down dramatically as a political compromise at the time, but they too have just had an election, and you don't see any right-wing parties, anti-immigrant parties, having a strong national profile in Germany. So they've done it, they've absorbed it, they've become stronger economically as a result of it, and they've moved on. And the United States has turned away from the xenophobic populism of the Trump administration. The Biden administration wants to normalize the status and create a pathway to citizenship for 13 million undocumented migrants. It wants to expand the H-1B visa quota. It wants to significantly overhaul and reform immigration for the United States. So the more we look case by case, the more we see that mass migrations have become a fact of life over the last 300 years, and particularly the last 75 years, and that actually we're a lot more used to it and accustomed to it, and quite frankly, good at it than we think we are when we focus very narrowly on the roiling political debates of the moment. I don't deny that those debates exist, but I'm pointing out very matter-of-factly that we're giving a very strong voice to parties and to, you know, concerns that, especially if they are racist and xenophobic, actually don't deserve that degree of attention because they have not won the argument. They've not won the debate. In fact, they really never do.
Very good, Parag Khanna. Well, let me ask you then, you have said that we must move people to where resources are, and people generally, you know, move to opportunities. The question is, what happens to countries like Afghanistan, which, you know, have centuries of history, you know, millennia of history, which are valid political entities, our sovereign countries? A country like Syria, one could say, well, it's a colonial construct, but what about these countries that are being emptied out? What happens to those places? Isn't that a bit of a disadvantage in this mass migration of people?
Well, there are countries that are being emptied out for a wide range of reasons. When we talk about emigration today, other than civil war situations and so on, We actually focus on Eastern Europe, which is a perfectly stable region. Many of those countries are members of the European Union, but they have very small populations, aging populations, and because they joined the EU, young people have been moving away and moving west to Western Europe, to the United States, and so on. And so it's very ironic that these are such livable, habitable, verdant geographies, places that, you know, despite climate change, can absorb large numbers of people, but they're actually depopulating, like Poland or Hungary and Czechia and Bulgaria and Romania and so forth. So that's an example of depopulation that has nothing to do with climate stress. Then you do also have countries, and I have a long section of the book about this, what I call vacant states, places that are just no longer livable. It doesn't have to be a whole country, but it could be parts of countries where there's a drought, where there's been a zero-day event, right, where simply the taps have run dry. And these are not places that people will necessarily go back to, absent a major infrastructural effort, desalination projects, and, you know, better water conservation and so forth. But a climate that's getting worse is going to tend to get worse, given where things are going with climate change. And that raises a very important legal issue or challenge, which is that, you know, when it comes to political refugees and asylum seekers, governments are saying, well, once your country becomes stable or stable enough, we are going to send you back. And that's happening to Syrians right now. And the Syrians are pleading to be allowed to remain. But under international law, there's a process by which governments can determine whether or not they feel that the country of origin is stable and they can send people back even if it's against their will. However, and imagine in a climate situation where a country is literally, matter-of-factly unlivable, literally just not survivable for people anymore. What are you going to do then? Right? You're going to send them back? No, you're not. So we need to think about this in a big picture, long-term kind of way. You know, we have an obligation to cope with these circumstances and disruptions and to absorb migrating populations that have an existential need to migrate and relocate them. And we need to think about where and how to do it. And it's not about just one country shouldering the burden or another country, but how can it be done in a shared fashion? And that's part of what the burden and the responsibility of mobility is.
We'll have more in just a moment, but first, you're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Castiel. Our special guest is Parag Khanna. He's the author of the recently published book, Move, The Forces Uprooting Us. This is a reminder that our Press Conference USA podcast is available for free download on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel, VOA. Well, here's a shout out to a loyal listener and Facebook fan from Kampala, Uganda, Kenneth Weonge. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to PCUSA@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to our special guest, author Parag Khanna. So Parag, in the past, you've also written a great deal about Asia and the importance of Asia, which of course is a large construct. You have said that the future of the world is Asian, and I'd like you to expand on that. Why? Why is it Asian and not necessarily African or Latin American?
Well, the center of human geography, right, the center of the world population is Asia, and it always will be Asia. Literally, the majority of mankind, of humankind, close to 5 billion people live in Asia. And the world population is reaching a plateau now. And in the next 10 to 20 years, we'll see the world population level off at probably less than 9 billion people, in which case, again, it's clear that the demographic epicenter is Asians in Asia. So even if you have continued population growth in Africa, which is happening, but fertility is coming down, still there's no other part of the world, not Europe, not Africa, not South America, not North America, that comes anywhere near the population size of Asia. Now, if you look at the world economy, Asia is also recovering fastest from this pandemic. And the growth rates are returning to what they were before the pandemic. You also have rapid urbanization, young populations, lots of foreign investment, diversification of economies, industry, innovation, all of these things are happening in Asia. So it really is the most remarkable regional story of our times, and it's going to continue to be. Now, that doesn't mean that the whole world subordinates itself to Asia. That's not my argument. My argument is that Asia is simply taking its rightful place historically alongside Europe, alongside North America, as, you know, one of the three dominant regional centers of the world. Now, that's not some kind of future forecast. You know, the book was called The Future is Asian, but that's because, you know, I could have said the present is Asian, but that wouldn't be as catchy a title. But the fact is that the present already is Asian and the future will also be Asian. But that, again, it's just about having more of a balance across the regional power centers, not that one will dominate the other. I actually believe the world will remain and be a multipolar for a long time to come.
Well, speaking of that, Parag Khanna, the world being multipolar and talking about Asia, we would be remiss if we didn't hone in on China. Of course, many in the West, particularly here in the United States, the Biden administration is portraying China, you know, as a major adversary, not least because of its refusal to respect fair trade, its violation of intellectual property. So I'd like to get your take on how you see China in this multipolar world. It certainly is an adversary from that point of view, but also because of this authoritarian system that it imposes not only within, and we're seeing even a consolidation and accentuation of that under Xi Jinping, but the fact that they tend to export this type of model, saying, well, the West is a mess, you know, look, they can't even pass bills or democracy doesn't work. Take a look at the United States, you know, so they are using that, particularly as they try to get more access to Africa and other developing nations through the Belt and Road Initiative. What's your sense of the role China plays, both positive and negative?
Well, China has risen so remarkably since the 1970s, since its economic reforms and opening, and become, you know, you leverage globalization. And with the full knowledge and assistance of all of the countries and businesses that invested in it, it's ridden the wave of globalization to become a superpower. And it's a global power, but that doesn't mean that it dominates Asia or dominates the world. It's the most important country in Asia. But remember that there are, first of all, demographically, about 3.5 billion Asians who are not Chinese. Most Asians live in democratic systems, not in China's style of government. And China has fairly antagonistic relations with all of its neighbors, so they don't necessarily look up to it. Countries, whether they're in Africa or South America or other parts of Asia, may admire Chinese infrastructure and high-speed rail and efficiency and investments in solar power and so forth. But that doesn't mean that they want to live under Chinese, you know, authoritarian dictatorship. I don't know anyone who wants to live under authoritarian Chinese dictatorship. Most Chinese people I know would prefer a slightly modified form of government than what they have today, one that's slightly more, you know, liberal and open, or a lot more liberal and open. So we make a big mistake when we conflate China with Asia, Chinese authoritarianism with Asian values. That's not true. In Asia, far more people live in democratic societies than non-democratic societies. So we need to empower those voices more than anything else so that they can speak up for themselves and remind the world and remind China that they are content with their form of government and don't plan to give up their form of government. So living with China, accommodating China, respecting China does not mean deferring to China, kowtowing to China, or subverting oneself to China. And I think that's really an important distinction. And I think that's where the foreign policy positions, the diplomatic strategies and military strategies of the West, the US and Europe both, are pointing towards. But again, China has every right to feel that it's accomplished, you know, incredible things economically and in terms of its social transformation in the last couple of decades. And that process continues. It's a high-tech, innovative, productive society. But the most important thing for China to do now is to reach out more, you know, intellectually, not just infrastructurally. And I've written extensively about Belt and Road. It was a, you know, huge part of my connectography book was about infrastructure, of course. And therefore, I focused extensively on Belt and Road. And Belt and Road is important in the sense that many countries in the world and many countries that are participants in it have very large populations. Their populations have tripled or quadrupled since post-colonial independence. They're relatively poor. So they do require foreign infrastructure, finance, and support. And China, therefore, comes at a very important time in terms of the partnership that it offers in the arena of infrastructure development. However, that doesn't mean that these countries want to become colonies, right? And China does not think in colonial terms the way Western colonial powers did. It's a mercantile actor, not so much a colonial actor. And there's a huge difference. A colonial country seeks direct administration of another society. That's what Britain did in India and so forth. That's clearly not what China wants. China wants countries to respect it, to play by its rules, to not violate its contracts, to basically have orderly and predictable relationships with China that favor China, but not to rule over them. And that's extremely important. But what Chinese leaders, what Chinese diplomats very often, officials, even intellectuals, tend to not fully grasp is that when they enter a country, especially a post-colonial country, it's a country and a society and a leadership that has direct living memory of being European colonies or of being pawns in the Cold War. And they're not going to let the same thing happen for a third time in their lifetimes. So the deck is really stacked against China ever generating the kind of goodwill that European colonial powers briefly enjoyed or that America enjoyed as a hegemon. Because, of course, countries have a knowledge of their own history, and they don't want the history of colonialism or the Cold War to repeat itself. And I don't think that, you know, the Chinese that I encounter have developed a sufficient capability, capacity, or approach to view the world through those eyes. And I travel to China very regularly before the pandemic, and I'm sure I'll continue to after. And this is precisely the message that I convey to them.
The question is, will they listen? I do take your points. It's just that the Chinese may not be neocolonial powers, but they do have a great deal of influence. And they are, in many ways, displacing, you know, local entrepreneurs in Africa, not just building infrastructure, which may be questionable in its quality and its execution. So, you know, the terms of finance aren't always in favor of the recipient country.
That's exactly right. So, you know, this is what some people call debt trap diplomacy and so forth. Now, let's remember that the word debt has started to take on this very negative connotation in the sense that, you know, this is a premeditated plot to ensnare countries in this debt. The truth is that no country, you know, necessarily can grow other than, you know, oil-rich countries or whatever without taking on some degree of debt and borrowing. Ideally, what happens is you borrow at affordable rates, you invest in the infrastructure improvement, in the economic diversification, in the growth and employment and so forth that allows your economy to eventually pay off that debt. That's the way it's supposed to work. And in quite a few countries, that is how it works with respect to China. But then there are countries that already were heavily indebted, either to China already, but mostly to Western creditors, and now actually are taking on more debt. And so they have to be hyper cautious. And yes, there are definitely secretive, murky aspects of the debt structure with China, with a number of these countries. But remember, you know, when you think about the ways in which private creditors have often treated these countries, it isn't terribly dissimilar. There is a fair bit of, again, this history repeating itself. So I think that no side is entirely clean, let's say. What the real issue is, to my mind, is that we've been here before. And precisely because we've been here before, we should have avoided, and these countries should have avoided, repeating these mistakes. And of course, therefore, it's sort of a combination of China obviously wanting to protect its investments and structuring deals so that it would benefit and it would get repaid first, right? Its creditors would be privileged. That's exactly what Western lenders have been doing for decades and more. But the fact that countries have been susceptible to these bad deals in some ways, especially if the interest rates are high, knowing that history and knowing that they can't afford it, that's where we need to focus our attention. How can we provide the technical assistance to these struggling governments or compete to provide lower interest rates and better terms to them so that they don't become overly dependent on just one country such as China?
Parag Khanna, let's talk about very briefly, you know, the impact of climate change and of course now pandemics, particularly as we're still navigating the coronavirus pandemic. What is the impact of these types of events and trends on immigration? What are the consequences?
It's, of course, really interesting. The pandemic lockdown of 1.5 years ago was really the single most coordinated act in the history of the world. And it was not to open borders and to liberate people, to enable free movement and mobility. It was the exact opposite. It was to lock down borders. And in many ways, people returned home to where they lived before. And now we kind of are at a kind of a great reset of a moment. Now, I do believe that we're going to have mass migrations again, and that it's totally inevitable, given climate change, given political instability, given economic crises, given also demographic imbalances and labor shortages in many economies that require that they absorb more migrants. So all of these factors, all of these drivers, and these are all very robust historical reasons why we have migration. All of those are in overdrive today, like hyperdrive. And so it's hard to imagine that just because we are experiencing a lockdown now, that that is some kind of a permanent condition, because it's, of course, not. The real trend of history is that mass migrations continue and are increasing. In fact, we've gone from just millions of people crossing borders every year to tens of millions. In the 20th century, it became hundreds of millions. And in this century, it will definitely be more than 1 billion people who will move. If you take just one driver, which is climate change, look at the estimates and the forecasts being issued by the IPCC and NASA and other agencies. They're saying that for every 1 degree of temperature rise, about 1 billion people get pushed out of the so-called climate niche, which is to say the sort of latitudes that are most propitious for human habitation. So just one issue, one cause alone is going to be a major factor in mass migrations.
And what about the impact? If people are fleeing the impact of climate change where they're living now and going to more favorable locations, will there be an imbalance for at least a period of time? And what are the consequences of that?
Right now, the countries that are absorbing migrants, like America, like Canada, Great Britain, Germany, they actually need more migrants. They literally need to absorb a larger workforce because they don't have a large enough tax base. They don't have enough caregivers and construction workers and all of these roles and functions in society. So migration is an unmitigated economic good. There's no doubt about it. There's cultural challenges and obstacles around assimilation, but there's strategies for that too. Language training, skills training, these kinds of things. And again, when you look at the reality from the bottom up, from the perspective of what's happening on the ground, you know, in Germany, in Canada, quite frankly, in the US as well, you actually do see that we're not as destabilized or unstable as a result of the diversity of migration as we tend to think from the outside. And that's a positive thing. And it actually shouldn't surprise anyone, because actually if there's one thing that Western societies have been doing incredibly well over the last 200 or 300 years, it's mass migration. It's absorbing migrants. So we shouldn't be surprised at all that it is a challenge today, but also that we can succeed at it because we have succeeded at it.
I think that's very well said. And as we close, I'd like you to talk about your firm, Future Map. Talk to us about why you created it and its main purpose.
Well, Future Map is the company that does scenario planning and data science and data visualization and strategic work for governments and companies both. And we help them get outside their comfort zone, think long-term, decide what their future plans are and how to get there and engineer strategies towards it. So, you know, we work all over the world. We work with a lot of governments across Asia, Middle East, Europe, Latin America, literally everywhere. And with companies as well that want to better understand the geographies of opportunity, markets of growth. And the primary tool is scenario planning. You don't know what's going to happen in the future, but what do you think might happen and what is the probability behind each of the scenarios that you envision? What is the scenario that you want to see happen and how can you make it happen through wise investments? And that's the kind of work that we do. And it's very gratifying.
Parag Khan is founder and managing partner of Future Map and author of the new book, Move, The Forces Uprooting Us. Parag Khan, congratulations on your new book, and thank you for sharing your keen insights about it and other experiences.
Thank you so much, Kyle. Really enjoyed it.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.